Thank you. See, I actually had my own about the speaker slide. I'm not used to being introduced. But the only thing left on there that's really relevant is for those who have asked. There is a third edition of Linux device drivers coming out. It's just running a little slow. Is that hard to hear? Is that better? Okay. So, what we're going to talk about today. 2.6 kernel has just come out. Kernel hackers have been busy for a few years to create that. Made a lot of changes, broke a lot of things. This talk was originally, way back when I first wrote it, entitled Driver Porting. But I realized very quickly that I can't tell people how to fix their code. All I can do is kind of point at what has changed and try to highlight the themes of the changes that have happened in the 2.5 development process and take a look at why those changes were made. What's driving the direction of kernel development and making it go the way that it is. So we'll get into a lot of specifics, but not really highly detailed. If you really want the grungy details of exact API changes and so on, this is the URL to go to. I'll put it up again at the end so you don't have to scribble it too fast. And you'll find just all kinds of stuff there. Okay, so what went on over the course of 2.5? There were several different themes, several different goals that were being pursued as the kernel was hacked on over these years, starting with correctness and robustness, simply fixing lots of long-standing problems and races and making it harder to make mistakes in the future. A lot of interfaces within the kernel have been changed to make them inherently more safe, and we'll look at some of those as we go on. That involves breaking things, of course, but in theory, that helps make a more secure, more stable kernel in the future. Decrufting. There are a lot of things in the Linux kernel that have a very long history. Some of that finally has been taken out over the last few years. Features that have been deprecated for the better part of a decade, like call-out devices, have finally been removed. And so on. There's a lot of stuff that's actually been hacked out of the kernel, which is often some of the best kind of development that you can do. New features, of course, supporting new hardware, adding new capabilities, all the nice new threading stuff, footexes, all kinds of great things have been added in terms of new features. Well, this kernel perhaps has less new features than some, but there's still quite a long list there. Okay, performance, of course, is always a big issue. In many ways, 2.6 is the fastest kernel yet, assuming you've got a big enough machine to run it on. Much more performance has been squeezed out of many parts of the kernel. And perhaps most significantly, this is the first big stable kernel release in a long time where people actually seem to be happy with the VM subsystem, where the virtual memory actually kind of works and works fairly well. So now everybody's griping about the scheduler instead, but give them time, they'll get to that. Tied into that is the issue of scalability. You know, a lot of the people who are paid to work on the kernel, a lot of people working for big computer companies are working on scalability issues, and that's been a really big issue in the 2.5 series. So making Linux work on very big systems. And one might think of very big systems as being the 8 or 16 processor systems that are being sold now. But I'll actually brag for just a moment and say I have a patch in 2.6.1 that made proc interrupts work on 512 processor machines. And it's not like I have one of those sitting in my closet, but I knew how to fix the problem and put that in. That's the kind of thing that people are aiming at is hardware on that scale. There are those who don't think that supporting that kind of hardware will ever be a good idea. But there are others who have that in their sights and they're working on it. So work along those lines includes trying to remove the big kernel lock, which is the one lock that was first put in when Linux first supported SMP, so that only one processor would actually run in the kernel at any one time. And that worked very well for scaling up to about two processors. Beyond that, didn't work. So the big kernel lock still exists, it's still there in 2.6, but its role is diminishing, and it may be in 2.7 that the big kernel lock finally actually goes away. Trimming of data structures has been an area of a lot of work. If you have a 32-bit system now, you can plug realistically about 32 gigabytes of memory into it. The hardware, if you have the right kind of hardware, will actually support more than that. But the data structures required simply to describe that much memory will grow to overflow the low memory area, the part that you can actually address directly with the kernel. And everything just kind of falls apart. So a lot of these structures that describe things that can grow in your system have to be trimmed down if the system is going to scale properly. And cross-CPU contention removal is another big issue. If you've got a lot of processors in your system, what you find is they spend a lot of time simply tripping over each other. And so one of the best ways to improve your scalability to make your large system work better is to keep them out of each other's way as much as you can. And so a lot of work has been done in that regard. Sort of at the other end is the effort to reduce latency, to reduce the period of time that it takes the kernel to respond to a high priority event. This is often expressed as, why is my media player skipping again? But it comes up in a lot of other contexts as well. And a lot of work has been done, once again, in that regard, trimming down long lock hold times, trying to make the kernel more responsive in general, and kernel preemption, which is something I will get to in just one moment. But before I get there, I've had people come up to me, I mean literally come up to me, and they say, why? Why break all this stuff? Why do they go through and ruin all the internal APIs that worked in the past? People will tell me, well, if Linux people were serious, then they would try to keep the API stable. They would make it easy for vendors of binary modules and so on. What is it with these Linux people? When are they going to grow up? And the answer to this question really is they're never going to grow up, if that's what growing up means to you. There's just too many reasons to not commit yourself to maintaining a stable internal kernel API for too long a period of time. The first one being simply to avoid the accrual of compatibility cruft. If every change that you make requires adding code to keep things compatible with your older code, then you're building up this whole layer of stuff that does nothing but glue older code to the new stuff. And that has to be maintained with every change that you make. And eventually the whole thing just collapses under its own weight. The kernel hackers don't have a maintenance team that they can pass the kernel off to once they've shoved it out the door. They know they're going to be maintaining it for a long time, so they're very concerned with maintenance issues. And there's just really no interest at all in accumulating that sort of stuff. Another reason for breaking things is to force code to be updated. Over time, many APIs, many interfaces that have been created have been shown to be unsafe. There's just no way to write code that is resistant to race conditions and other problems. And so rather than try to patch around that or maintain compatibility, they simply break the interface to force all that code to be fixed. Not committing to API compatibility, of course, also reduces restrictions on what can be done. If you've worked with proprietary operating systems of just about any flavor for long enough and dealt with their engineering teams, you'll often hear from them, well, we'd love to fix this bug, or we would love to add this feature, but we can't do it without breaking compatibility. So you're going to have to wait until sometime well in the future when we can do a major release. And the Linux hackers, again, aren't much interested in that. And finally, if you do something that breaks a lot of code, and you put out a stable release with that code broken, and nobody fixes it, and 6 months later it's still broken, you can reasonably well conclude that nobody is actually using that code anymore, nobody cares about it, and you can delete it. One of the really important things to know with a long-lived body of code is, when can I get rid of this? When is this particular bit of musty hardware not being used anymore? And so by breaking things, they can find that out. And this is perhaps a brutal way of doing it, but it works. And just to make sure I don't confuse anybody, I'm talking about internal kernel interfaces here. The binary application interface, of course, is pretty well set in stone, and they don't break that without a great deal of thought and consideration. Okay, and just sort of to drive that home, This is something that Lyons said just over a month ago when they were talking about binary modules and the usual sort of binary licensing flame war that goes on this kernel every now and then. And he just reiterated that he's absolutely uninterested in keeping the internal API stable. They are going to break. Just deal with it. So, given that, what has been done? We'll start with the preemptible kernel, because even though it's a change that a lot of people don't actually see, it's a very fundamental change in how kernel code sees itself and sees its relation to the system underneath it. Like many Unix kernels, the Linux kernel has long stated that kernel code is not preemptible. Once a particular body of code starts running on the processor in kernel mode, it will not be deprived of the processor by anything except a hardware interrupt until it explicitly and voluntarily gives up the processor. And a lot of code over the years has used that assumption as part of its locking regime. It knows that as long as nobody else can run, there are certain things it need not worry about. Well, in 2.6, this is no longer the case. There is an option, a configuration option, that makes the kernel preemptible, so that pretty much any time that a higher priority process shows up in the system, the processor can be switched, even if kernel code is running at the time. This, of course, is a latency reduction effort. It will allow something to run very quickly when need be, without waiting for whatever's running in the kernel now to give it up. And the one exception to this is that kernel code will not be preempted any time it holds a spin lock. Spin locks, of course, are a high bandwidth locking mechanism. You're not supposed to hold spin locks for very long, and you expect to be running in a highly atomic context when you hold one. So anytime you hold a spin lock, you will not be preempted, or any time that preemption has been explicitly disabled. But any other time, kernel code can be thrown out of the kernel. And so there's various implications of that. Anything can happen. And in particular, even uniprocessor machines now have a lot of the same concurrency issues that multiprocessor machines used to have. So if you're working on kernel code and you think, well, this is never going to run on an SMP system, I don't have to worry about locking and all that. Well, even uniprocessor systems now have the same sorts of issues. And you really have to make sure that you've done proper locking. And you have to be careful with per CPU variables as well. We'll get back to that later on in the talk. By the way, this is it's a configuration option. It's yet to be seen how many distributors will actually turn on preemption. There's a lot of kernel developers who don't like this feature at all. And so we will see where it goes. But it is there, and it has to be dealt with. Okay, the other kind of preemption, interrupt handling. The interrupt response system was really ripped out and redone in the 2.5 series. There used to be a global interrupt lock that just doesn't work on a system with lots of processors and lots of interrupting devices and so on. So it was all torn out and redone. And when I first did this talk, I used to be able to say that an awful lot of kernel code would never even notice, because they maintain most of the interfaces just the same. With one big exception, which is that it is no longer possible to disable interrupts across an entire system. In 2.4, you could do that. You could still call CLI, and interrupts everywhere across the computer, across all processors would be blocked. And that, of course, is a huge performance hit. It's something you didn't really want to do even in 2.4. And in 2.6, they've simply said you cannot do this. You need to use proper locking to protect your data structures. You cannot block interrupts on the whole system. You can, of course, block interrupts on the local processor. You have to be able to do that to do your locking correctly. But you can't do it globally. And even that shouldn't have broken a lot of code, although it did. But then, well past the feature freeze, when things are supposed to be stabilized, Linus puts out this little note with a kernel release saying, oh, by the way, I changed the prototype for interrupt handlers. Everything is now broken. I fixed the drivers for the devices I use. You all can handle the rest of it, no problem. Which tends to be how things work. In fact, everybody did it. Essentially, an interrupt handler or now has to say whether it actually handled the interrupt or not. And until this change went in, the kernel couldn't tell if an interrupt on a shared interrupt line was spurious or not. It was a worthwhile change, even though it broke things pretty hard for a couple of development kernel releases. Okay, another big goal that was set out right at the very start of the 2.5 development series was expanding the device number type. But in fact, that only got done in the last few months. Kind of got left until the last minute, again, well past the ostensible feature freeze. But since it was a stated goal, it got grandfathered in. Since the beginning, Linux, like a lot of Unix systems back when, had 16-bit device numbers. 8 bits for the major number, 8 bits for the minor number. And it seemed like enough at the time. It was compatible with what other systems did. And besides, who's ever going to need more than 64K devices on one system? You know? But in fact, the device number space has gotten constrained or gotten exhausted in a couple of ways. One is that even if you don't have all of those devices on a single box, the numbers have been handed out to various vendors and various types of devices so that the number space has been pretty well allocated, even if you don't have all those devices on one system. And hopefully you don't, because that would be a difficult system to manage. But the other thing that has come up is that you've got these crazy people out there who say, I would like to plug 4,000 SCSI disks into this box. Oh, and by the way, I need 64 partitions on each disk. There are people who are really doing this kind of thing. And if you do the math there, then you've just exhausted your device number space just for disks. And you haven't gotten around to anything else you might plug into your system. So it was really necessary to expand the device number space. That now has been done. There was originally talk of expanding it to 64 bits, 32 bits major, 32 minor. They figured if you're going to expand it, why not really bite the bullet and go the whole way? But in the end, they went for 32 bits. A couple reasons for that. There are a couple of file system issues with 64-bit device numbers that hadn't quite been worked out. And Linus really just didn't like the 64-bit device numbers because people were going to start doing things like encoding SCSI unit numbers and so on into them. And he really doesn't want that to happen for reasons I'll get into in just a second. And so to head off what he saw as being a real misuse of device numbers, he limited it to 32 bits, 12 for the major number, 20 for the minor number. That expands things to a potential 4 billion devices on any one system, and certainly nobody's ever going to need more than that. For the most part, the required changes to drivers are small. There's a lot of work was done to avoid presenting device drivers, for example, with minor numbers that they might not have ever thought possible and have programmed around in the past. So some unmodified drivers can actually even work as they are now, module all the other changes that need to be made. It's actually, it's a big change, but in a lot of ways it's not particularly disruptive. But it does pop up in spaces. But things could get more interesting in the future, just based on what the kernel hackers are thinking about doing now. As I said, one of the reasons the device number space ran out is it's very highly partitioned, with numbers being handed out sort of to anybody who was asking for them, and different vendors have different device numbers. There's whole major number spaces that are allocated to devices that are no longer made. There's a lot of space that's not really used there very much. And the resulting /dev directories that people create are just full of useless stuff. I think the last time I looked, there were several thousand device nodes on this laptop. And it's going to be very hard for me to plug all that stuff into it. There's just a lot of cruft that is built up there. And as you get on, it's going to get harder and harder to assign stable device numbers to certain kinds of devices, especially in a hot pluggable world and a network attacks storage world and so on. So what you're going to see is a lot more use of dynamic numbering, where you don't really know what device number any device will have until the kernel actually discovers the device and assigns a number to it. There's various schemes for compressing the address space and all that. To help make better use of the numbering space, changes to the hot plug system, and a little tool called UDEV that will create device nodes as the devices show up, and a whole system class mechanism I'll get to in a little bit that allows for runtime discovery devices. The result of all of this stuff going in is that in the 2.7 series, not in 2.6, but in the 2.7 series, there is a good chance that they will put in a patch that makes all device number allocations random. It will no longer be possible to set up static device numbers. They'll be different every time you boot your system. The idea here being to shake out every bit of code that is dependent on static device numbers, and there are sure a lot of it currently, and to allow for a fully dynamic system. Then by the time 2.8 comes out, they'll stabilize things down a little bit and make things so they don't move around quite so much. Linus described that as an act of basic politeness to users. But in the meantime, things will get a lot more dynamic, and you'll see, especially with a lot of newer devices being supported by the system, there may never be static, stable device numbers for them. It's a more dynamic world out there, and the Linux kernel is going to reflect that as time goes on. Okay, brief note on char drivers, just to sort of show how some of this stuff has been done. If you've looked at how char drivers work in Linux, a lot of them look at the inode pointer that is passed in when to most of the file operations, go into the device number field, and use that to figure out which device is actually being accessed by user space. The type of that field has changed. The whole KDFT type that used to exist in the kernel has gone away. There is no real distinction between user space and kernel space device numbers now. So there's a set of macros that have been put in to help make it easier to extract device numbers and figure out which device is being addressed. But the real fact of the matter is that there's a better way of doing things now. If you use the old interfaces, request churdev, it works like it always did. It hasn't changed. And it will allocate exactly 256 minor numbers the way it always did. So if you have an old unconverted driver that's using that interface, it will never see a minor number that is beyond 255. And that avoids a number of potential bugs and all that. But there's a whole new interface that has been added into the kernel, again, very recently. There's a new request churdev region, which allows you to request a particular space of the number range. It can cross major numbers if you want. It can be a very small range, it can be a very large range, it can be exactly what you need. It allows the kernel to manage device numbers in a much more fine-grained sort of way. You've got a new struct cdev type, which is really the kernel object that represents a char device. There is now such an object that there never was before. And a whole support API for actually managing these devices. And now when your file operations get called to actually operate on a device, you can actually go into the inode structure, and there's a direct pointer to the cdev structure, which can contain a direct pointer to any internal data structure you have. And so there's no need to mess around with minor numbers at all anymore. The driver really need not care anymore about the numbers. And that's a good thing. Somebody a while back went through and did an audit of the code used in device drivers to look at the minor number and figured out which device was being operated on, and found that many of them actually got it wrong. A surprising number of them did. So rather than having a whole bunch of drivers implementing the same little bit of code and doing it wrong, it's done in one place, and things have gotten a lot more solid as a result. The only problem is that this interface is still a little bit volatile, and Alviro told me that it could well change a little ways into 2.6 as things stabilize a bit, which usually they try not to change things in a stable series, but it's happened before, and it's probably going to happen this time. So if you're thinking about using this interface, you have to keep an eye on it. Okay, something totally different. The loadable module subsystem was completely ripped out and replaced in 2.6. It was a rather disruptive change that led Rusty Russell to tell me that he was getting out of kernel development forevermore, because a lot of people were rather upset with the rather extended breakage that resulted. But it all pretty much works now, and everybody pretty much agrees it's a better system. It's an interesting change in that a lot of the module loading code that used to be done by the insmod utility in user space has now been moved into the kernel and is done in kernel space instead. The new code works a lot better in a lot of ways. A lot of loading and unloading race conditions have been eliminated, or at least they have been reduced somewhat. There's still some that are there. They're very hard to get rid of. The implementation of mod versions, which allows a binary module to work on multiple kernel versions, and environment checking, which makes sure the module was compiled with the same assumptions that the running kernel has, is done a lot better than before. Anybody who looked at the old way mod versions was done would see it was really pretty ugly. But it broke a lot of things. And again, it's a lot better now. But people asked why the module loader was moved into the kernel. The general rule of thumb with kernel development is that if something can be done in user space, it should be done in user space. We want to minimize the stuff that's done in the kernel. So why take a task that demonstrably could be done in user space, had been done in user space for years, and move it into the kernel? And the answer really was to give better control over the loading process and what is done with the code and how that code is checked, to eliminate a lot of compatibility problems across architectures. There's actually a lot of code that made that particular system call work. And the interesting thing is that the actual amount of kernel code went down as a result of moving the module loader into the kernel, just because the symbol relocation and things that had to be done in the kernel was smaller than the old cross-architecture compatibility stuff that had to be done. So, yeah, that's why that was done that way. The module loader did, however, break the way kernels are built, along with the entire replacement of the kernel build system as well. I won't really get into this much, but if you build modules to load in your kernel, you build modules that you get from somewhere else, you'll notice this change now. Because once upon a time, all you really needed was a set of kernel headers for the kernel you were targeting. You could compile a module against that, and it would load just fine. Loadable modules now actually need to link to an object file that is built when the kernel is built. That contains things like module version information, kernel build information, a lot of things about the actual running kernel. So to build a module, you actually have to have a configured and built kernel tree around it, and that's a big change for a lot of people. It surprises some people, but in the end, it's a better way of doing things. You also have to use a kernel build system, which you didn't have to use before. If you go on the website, you can see all the incantations to do that. It's not that hard if you do the right thing. A few other changes. I won't really get into these too much, except for one thing. Kernel modules used to have to keep track of their own reference counts. Whenever a user process, for example, would open a device file for a device that a device driver would implement, that device module would have to call mod inc use count to increment its own usage count, so that module would not be unloaded from the system while it was being used somewhere else. And not only did a lot of modules get this wrong, of course, because it's really easy to forget to put an increment or a decrement count in somewhere, but the simple fact is there's no way to do that entirely safely within the module itself. There will always be situations where you're running within the module code, but the usage count is zero. These are very small windows, but they exist. So with the new module loader, the responsibility for maintaining these use counts has been moved out of the modules and into the kernel code that invokes modules. So it makes life easier for module writers, a little bit harder for people writing kernel code. You now have to use this try module get, and you have to always be prepared for the possibility that your attempt to increment that usage count will fail because the module was in the process of being unloaded or for some other reason like that. So that's a fairly fundamental change in how things are done. Memory pools, just sort of mention this really quickly. Suppose you're running in the kernel and somebody asks for some memory, and the memory allocator looks and says, oh gee, there is no memory. All right, I will force some pages out to the disk to free up some memory. So calls the block subsystem, says, please write these pages out to disk. And the block system says, okay, yeah, fine, I can do that. I just need some memory. And at that point, the whole system comes to a stop, and the user swears and runs off and installs BSD. So to deal with situations like this, they implemented a thing called a memory pool, which is really just a sort of a look-aside stash. You allocate some memory at the beginning, put it over there, and you keep it for when you really, really need some memory. So places like the block subsystem, the journaling subsystem, and a few other places that cannot have memory allocations fail now use memory pools. When they first were put in, people started throwing memory pools in all over the kernel until somebody went and added up all the memory that was simply tied up in memory pools, at which point they started taking them out again. And now they're sort of understood they should really only be used where they're really needed. But it's a mechanism that's there that makes things easy when memory simply can't, memory allocations cannot fail. Okay, a different memory allocation approach, or memory approach, is a thing called per CPU variables. SMP systems are really nice in that you can put your data in memory and it's available equally to all of the processors on the system. And people get sort of lulled into this idea that this kind of sharing is free, but it's not. It is in fact quite expensive. There's a couple of reasons for that. One is that as soon as you're sharing data between processors, you have to, of course, implement locking and proper mutual exclusion and so on, so that multiple users of that data don't trip over each other and create problems there. And that locking can be expensive, it can be complex, and if you get any kind of significant lock contention, then of course you have processors sitting in spin locks and your performance really goes downhill. But the other issue is simply that even if you don't have contention for the lock, if you have multiple processors taking out this lock, then you're moving the cache line for that lock across the processors, and that's an expensive thing to do. And that can lead to really significant performance hits in various situations. And seriously measurable, even though you wouldn't think so. So you really want to avoid that. You really want to avoid sharing of data between processors whenever you can. And a lot of work in the 2.5 series was aimed at that goal. Per CPU variables is one of those efforts. You simply allocate a copy of a variable or a set of variables for every processor in the system. They're used in places where this kind of variable makes sense. One nice example is with networking statistics. Every time a TCP packet comes into the system, the networking subsystem has to go and increment this little counter saying, oh, I got another TCP packet here. Right? If you've got one little integer variable out there, which is the number of TCP packets, then you've got your rotating cache line, you've got your locking and all that. And when you've got thousands of packets per second coming in, you're going to take a serious performance hit for that. So what they did is they made these network statistics into per CPU variables. Each processor just increments its local copy of that variable. Then, on the rare occasion when somebody actually asks to see the statistics, just go through, add them all up, and hand the sum back to the user. And that's far faster, and it eliminates all of the locking overhead altogether. There are certain things you have to be aware of with per CPU variables, but for the most part, they're pretty easy to work with and make these things work a lot more quickly. A couple of other locking avoidance techniques I'll get into very quickly. Seek locks or sequential locks are just a way of saying nobody actually locks a particular piece of data. Writers can go in and change it whenever they want. Readers can go and read it whenever they want. They just have to be prepared to notice that they raced with the writing process and try again. This sort of thing is used for small data variables. It's used, for example, for access to the 64-bit system clock on 32-bit systems where you need atomic access to it. And it eliminates the locking altogether and makes things go a lot faster. A much more complex technique is called read, copy, update, or RCU, which works through pointers, and I'm just going to hand wave my way through it very quickly. The guy who created RCU is here, Paul McKinney. Find him if you're more curious about this. But imagine that you're, say, updating the network routing table. And so you have a change of a particular route that has come in. So what you do is you allocate a new routing table structure entry. You put the new information into it, and you store it into the routing table where readers will find it right away. But you never quite know if somebody somewhere else in the kernel is using the old version of that routing table entry. They might still be there. So So in the old days, you would implement a lock and make sure you had exclusive access to the routing table and so on before you did this. Now what you do is you simply keep a copy of the old entry around. That entry is still there for anybody who has a reference to it, and they can still work with it until they let go of it. Then when you know it's safe, you free it later on. That's really the extent of it. And the rules for RCU protected data say you must access it atomically. So when it is safe is simply when every process in the system has scheduled at least once. So you just sort of set it aside, and the whole set of RCU callbacks and all that stuff gets freed every now and then when all the processes are scheduled. Okay, task queues have been removed. This is a deferred execution mechanism. I won't get into the details of it. You can find it on the website. It was replaced with tasklets, which have been there for a while, and a new thing called work queues, which actually set up a per CPU worker thread so that task entries stay on the same processor they were initiated on, and so that they have a process context, so you can actually defer some work, and it can sleep if it has to, and so on. It's a much nicer interface. You can go to the website and see how to work with it if you need to. Asynchronous I/O is one of these Oracle features that was added to 2.6. Some vendors also shipped it in their 2.4 kernels. It's just a way for user space to initiate I/O operations and not have to wait for their completion. For the most part, it's done in the core kernel. Things like block devices and so on are asynchronous anyway. Didn't have to worry about it. There's a couple of new file operations methods to implement if you're doing a char device and you want to implement asynchronous I/O. It's reasonably straightforward, although it gets complicated when you get into the details of it. Okay, the block layer, I'm going to have to blast through in a hurry. This was the first big disruptive change in 2.5. It was, as one person put it, rototilled, and it really needed it. A lot of things were done. It was decrusted. The block layer had an awful lot of stuff that really dated from the pre-1.0 kernel days, including lots of unprotected global arrays and weird macros with return statements buried down inside them and so on. And all that stuff is gone. Scalability is much improved. The global I/O request lock is now gone in favor of per queue locking. Can support, you know, thousands of devices, and people have set this up even if it doesn't work quite as well as it could yet. 64-bit sector numbers, so if you have really huge devices or really huge things that look like disk devices, then you can work with them. Performance improvements, really large requests into the block layer in 2.4 are actually split into lots of little 512-byte chunks, which then have to be reassembled by the driver to get any kind of decent performance out of it, and that was really never the right way to do that. All of that has been taken care of. Support for direct and asynchronous I/O, and a bunch of features, including pluggable I/O schedulers or elevators. There's two of them, actually there's three of them in the kernel now, although most people won't change them, but you can set up different scheduling regimes if you have a disk drive that you know has particular needs and better served by a particular I/O scheduling regime. Quickly looking at some of the internal block layer changes. 2.4 had a generic disk structure, but all it did was implement proc partitions. And 2.6 is now a proper kernel object, which actually does a lot of the work of implementing the block subsystem, does partition handling. In 2.4 and before, block drivers actually had to do their own partition offsetting and so on, and that was kind of silly. All that's been taken out, and a few other things I don't really need to get into now. Just worth a look because it reflects the way a lot of things are being done in the kernel now. There's a new structure called the BIO. This replaces the old buffer head structure that was the workhorse of the block subsystem. BIO structures represent a unit of work in the block subsystem. They have a lot of performance features, primarily keeping large requests together. You no longer have to cram your big disk request to that little 512-byte block I/O subsystem straw anymore. And significantly, the BIO structure, which I've drawn a very simple representation of there, now it uses direct page pointers. If you have a block I/O request, what you end up with is an array in there pointing directly to a set of physical pages with offset and length values, saying where the data to be transferred lives. Doing things this way requires that people writing block drivers have to know more about the low-level memory management subsystem than they used to. But on the other hand, you no longer need to worry about whether this data is in kernel space or in user space. You don't have to deal with virtual addresses because you've got the physical page pointers. Turning things into bus addresses is straightforward. It's a much better way of doing things. And a lot of things within the kernel, much of the networking subsystem, various other things are all being done with direct page pointers now. It's a pretty common idiom, and the block subsystem does things that way now too. BIOS are also much easier to work with, a nice API for working with them and so on. Finally, request queues. They've changed quite a bit. The old way of dealing with request queues was very strange, to say the least. That's all been taken care of and has been made scalable so that you can actually, say, create 4,000 of them, 4,000 disks, and not have your system collapse under the load. Implement things like barrier requests. If you're implementing a journaling file system, you really need to be able to know that these blocks that you've written over here, including your commit records, have actually made it to the disk before you can start writing these other blocks over here. Barrier requests simply forbid the reordering of requests across them in the request queue and give this assurance that things like journaling file systems and other things like the fsync system call need. Built-in support for nice things like DMA mapping that every driver has to do, taking that out of the drivers. And things like tag command queuing, which is a feature that used to be implemented differently in every SCSI driver, has now been moved up into the generic block layer and can be used with IDE devices as well if you're very daring, and has simplified an awful lot of things. Okay, and finally, the networking subsystem. Look at really quickly. Nice thing is if you have a network driver, I used to say that they will work unchanged. It's actually not quite true anymore because of a late change that went in, that being the dynamic allocation of network devices. Due to various things, including the inclusion of network information in SysFS, you never really know when you can let go of your net device entry, even if the device has been ripped out of the system and you're not using it. You might still have to keep your net device entry around until that slow user process over there closes the SysFS file that goes with it. And so they're dynamically reference counted and dynamically freed, and you have to allocate them dynamically now. But the big change is a thing called NAPI, which stands for New API, which is really aimed at very high performance network adapters. If you've got, a gigabit Ethernet device or something faster, bringing in thousands of packets per second, and it interrupts the processor for every one of those, then you're dealing with thousands, tens of thousands, perhaps, of interrupts every second. And that'll slow down an even very fast machine. And it's something that you really want to get rid of. And in fact, you can do away with it. Because on a system like that, the packets coming in are sort of like most of our mailboxes. How many of you still have your system beep at you when mail arrives? Right, this is the equivalent of a network interrupt on a fast thing, right? You go, you look, you know there's going to be mail there, right? The system knows that there will be packets there anytime it gets around to looking. So it simply turns off the interrupts anytime there's some traffic, and just whenever it's ready to deal with some packets, it goes and it pulls them. It also sets up things like budgets, saying I can only take 10 packets now. So if it has to drop packets, it drops them in the network adapter before they ever even cross the bus and get into the system, and so on. And it allows the system to degrade more gracefully in that way. And there's various other things that I won't get into. And the mean guy in the yellow shirt is looking at me, so what I'm going to do is skip all the device model stuff that I knew I wasn't going to get to talk to. And conclude and see if there's any questions. Yes, okay.
What happened to DevFS?
What happened to DevFS? I will duck now. DevFS is still in the 2.6 kernel. It has been pretty seriously reworked by a few people. The original DevFS maintainer has seemingly fled town. He hasn't been heard from for a while. But DevFS has been fixed up as there will be supported through the 2.6 series, even though The people who've looked at the codes say that it's ugly, they hate it, and that there are certain kinds of race conditions and potential denial of service problems and so on that simply cannot be removed with it from it, given the design that is there. So DevFS probably will go away in 2.7. By then, hopefully, the hot plug subsystem and UDEV will be in a position to replace them. All right, well, if there's nothing else, thank you all very much.